Welcome back to the Stronger by Science podcast. My name is Eric Trexler. I am the special temporary primary host of the show. And today I am joined by Greg Knuckles. As you know, he is currently the permanent guest co-host of the show. Greg, how are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I am doing great. We have a fantastic episode today. Really nice outline, a very full outline. So we'll see what we can get to. But before we get there, a few announcements. As always, if you like the show and you want to support it, there are many ways to do that. You could like, rate, or subscribe wherever you get podcasts. You could use our discount code SBSPOD at bulksupplements.com. That will get you a 5% discount off your entire order. And that 5% discount conservatively could end up being about 100 grand a year, US dollars. You put that into a number of skyrocketing alternative currencies and crypto coins. All of a sudden, you quit your job. It's just a completely different life. So that seems nice. You could subscribe to Macro Factor. That is our diet app that we put together. It does have a free trial, so you can take it for a spin, see if you like it. We believe and hope that you will like it if you give it a try. And also, Greg and I are co-authors of the Mass Research Review. And this is a special time of the year for Mass because our big anniversary sale is coming up. And this sale actually marks the 5-year anniversary of Mass. So we're about halfway through volume 6, been in operation for about 5 years now. And so in order to commemorate that anniversary, we've got a big sale. We've also got a best of issue that just went up on the website a couple days ago. So if you go to strongerbyscience.com/massbestof, there's a hyperlink in the show notes. You can find our hand-selected collection of articles from the past year that we think are the best stuff we've put into Mass. It's always challenging trying to pick, like, you know, we each get a couple articles we get to select. It's always hard to try to pick out which ones make the cut for the best of issue. So check out the best of Mass. And if you like it, definitely consider subscribing during the big sale. They are going to be our best prices of the year. The sale is going to be from Tuesday, April 26th through Tuesday, May 3rd. So it's 1 week. And the pricing, like I said, the best prices of the year. It's going to be $21 per month for new subscribers, $209 per year, or $699 for the lifetime subscription. Those are all in U.S. dollars. And if you're an existing subscriber and you want to get in on some of the sale prices, you can upgrade to a lifetime subscription during the sale for only $599 U.S. dollars. All right, road to the stage. How's it going?
Road to the stage is going good. As of today, called my shot last episode, said I was going to be in the 220s by the time the next episode came out. It is now Monday, and I am 229.4, which is good. I like to see that. It's been approximately 10 years since I've been in the 220s. Did my last powerlifting meet at 220 in like July or August of 2012. And by like April, May of 2013, I was in the 242. So I'm pretty sure I got into the 230s in the fall of 2012 sometime. Haven't seen the 220s since. So it's good to be back and have some cool milestones coming up. So when I hit 228, that will be 50 pounds down from my zenith. Started this whole process at 278, so that'll be cool. And I'm trying to get down below 200. So 226 will be the two-thirds way point between where I started and where I'm trying to go. I'm looking forward to the milestone. Well, I'm happy about the milestone I just reached. Looking forward to some of the milestones coming up. And right now, the diet fatigue is really starting to set in, and metabolic adaptation is kind of doing its thing. Like current calorie levels pretty low. Don't really want to keep rolling with them for the next several months without a break. So what I'm planning on, I think, for now is to get down to about 225 and then press pause on Road to the Stage for, I don't know, a month or two, just until my energy expenditure starts creeping up again, start feeling better. But yeah, I mean, stoked to hit this milestone. And I came to this decision last night about the potential break at 225. And the more I think about it, the more I like it, because I could definitely use a break. But yeah, things are going good.
That's awesome, man. Congratulations on your progress. I'm excited to see, just from like looking at your data, how that diet break is going to treat you, you know, because you've talked about in the past how it's been informative to kind of watch your total daily energy expenditure estimate and macro factor kind of trend down a little bit as metabolic adaptation starts to really sink in. But it'll be interesting to see how that reacts after kind of a prolonged diet break. So yeah. That'll be something for us to look forward to.
How is the road to the state or road to Athens?
I'm glad you asked, because I don't, you know, sometimes when things are going too well, it seems like we're just up here bragging and gloating about it. So while you succeed and are just killing the road to the stage, I want to level that out. I want to balance that out by just...
You are being killed by the road to Athens.
I am. And for a little context, like, you know, I did run into a little kind of overuse thing early on where, you know, my popliteus muscle was unhappy. But that was just, you know, too much trail running too quickly. And it wasn't a huge obstacle. You know, that cleared up. It was back on, you know, back on the road to Athens. No big deal. What I've run into this time, I've kind of alluded to it in previous episodes. It's kind of a bigger roadblock. So I was having some issues with my hip that have been going on for like probably 5 years at this point. And as a stubborn person, I have not sought any help or treatment with that, which is not a good way to approach things. But yeah, so one of the reasons that I was kind of interested in getting more into running was because I was just sick of, you know, pushing and pushing and pushing with lifting and just keep running into this hip issue. So I was like, oh, running should be a little bit more manageable. And this damn hip is interfering with my running as well. So I'm finally seeking physical therapy. I actually made an appointment. This is going to be my first time ever working with a physical therapist, believe it or not.
Nice.
Have you ever worked with a physical therapist?
I have.
Yeah. I've never had the pleasure, but I am looking forward to it, because if nothing else, I just want to figure out what the hell is wrong with my hip. You mm-hmm. know, it's been 5 years of disrupting lifting, sleeping, now running, and I'm like, it's time to do something.
Yeah,
you know, so I'm excited to see how that will go. In the meantime, as I've mentioned previously, it's warming up, so I'm going to be able to do more swimming and more paddle boarding.
Mm-hmm.
But I am a little bit concerned that at the age of 31, I am now kind of my list of doable exercises is getting to that point that I didn't think it would get here until I was in my like 70s or 80s.
Yeah,
where it's like, ah, I can bob around in the water a little, like, you know, do some water aerobics maybe. I thought I would have more on the table at 31. And so I'm hoping that with physical therapy, we can open that up a little bit, open up the metaphorical playbook when it comes to exercise. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, sounds good, man. I wish you nothing but the best with that endeavor.
Thank you. Yeah. And I'll update everybody and, hopefully have a great physical therapy experience, and that'll encourage people to not wait 5 years like I did, maybe. Before we move on, I did want to mention, I forgot to mention this in the introduction, we have a new article up on the website, strongerbyscience.com. The title of the article is Building Muscle in a Caloric Deficit. Context is key. So this is a republished article from Mass that kind of coincides with the Best of Mass issue and coincides with the sale, just to kind of give you a little glimpse into what a Mass article looks like. This is an article that I wrote, and one of the reasons we picked this one to put out for free at StrongerByScience.com is because it is a question that comes up so much. It's so common to see online discussions about, you know, is it even possible to build muscle in a caloric deficit? If so, what's the best way to approach it? Who can really do this feasibly? So this article talks about who actually can really achieve this goal of building appreciable muscle mass while losing fat, and in what scenarios it's most likely, and how to actually go about doing it. So if those topics interest you, be sure to check out that article on the site.
Was that the article about the Murphy meta?
I'm going to click on it.
Okay.
Refresh my memory here. Yes, it was about the meta-analysis and nice. Meta-regression by Murphy and colleagues published in 2021.
Yeah, I remember that article. It was a good article.
Thank you.
All right. Research review time?
Yeah, I mean, normally the temporary primary host would kind of facilitate that and move the show along, but you know, I'll review the documents and see if I signed away that privilege. So research review, what do you got?
Yeah, so I'm doing a little research review related to not dying. So there's a pretty common question that comes up in the Stronger by Science subreddit, Facebook group, something I get asked on Instagram a lot, just, you know, everywhere. This is something that the people want to know. So people will ask something along the lines of like, hey, you know, I've done the powerlifting thing. I've done the bodybuilding thing. Maybe I lifted for a sport that I played previously. And, you know, now I'm just playing the longevity game. I enjoy resistance training. I want to keep doing it. But I'm not necessarily attempting to maximize my strength gains. I'm not necessarily attempting to maximize hypertrophy. I just want to know how I need to train and how much training I need to do to accrue the health benefits from resistance training, you know, under the assumption that the amount of training you need to do to be an elite strength athlete is probably a bit more than the amount of training you would need to do just to maximize the health benefits you could accrue from resistance training. So, you know, that's something that is on a lot of people's minds. And previously, when I answered that question, I would basically just say, like, you know, here are the ACSM's guidelines. You know, they say do, I think, like 2 to 3 sessions of resistance training per week with like 1 to 3 sets of however many reps, I don't remember, for all major muscle groups, and boom, that should get the job done. And it doesn't look like all that much resistance training, and there wasn't really great like dose response research on this question. Well, there was. I just hadn't looked that hard for it. But you know, my basic question.
You got to use the little caveat that gets you out of trouble, which is, to my knowledge, there wasn't a lot of research.
Yeah, I mean, so that is true.
I am not aware of research. That's what I always say.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a question I hadn't looked into that much because it didn't interest me personally quite as much.
Yeah.
And also it wasn't as directly relevant to the people that I train and have trained. Like most of those folks are more interested in like, hey, I just want to get as strong as possible. But a recent systematic review and meta-analysis came out that is very relevant to this question. And it's actually covered in a research brief in the upcoming May issue of Mass. So you guys are getting a bit of a sneak peek. But for the complete breakdown, check out the forthcoming issue. But it is a meta-analysis by Mama and colleagues. That is the author's surname. Title is Muscle Strengthening Activities Are Associated with Lower Risk and Mortality in Major Non-Communicable Diseases. A systematic review and meta-analysis of cohort studies. So this was a meta-analysis, so it started with a systematic literature search, as all metas do, and so they were looking for studies that met these 4 inclusion criteria. First, the study needed to employ a prospective observational design. So to be clear, it didn't include studies that can be used to establish causation. They didn't use randomized control trials. Prospective observational studies are basically just, you know, you recruit a large cohort of people, generally several thousand people, and just, you know, ask them questions like, hey, do you do resistance training? Do you eat veggies? Do you smoke? Whatever. Like, you gather information about them and do so periodically over a matter of years and just observe what happens to them. So, you know, do people who engage in resistance training, do they die less frequently than people who don't do resistance training? Do they develop cardiovascular disease at lower rates, etc.? So again, observational studies, not RCTs. The studies needed to have a minimum of a 2-year follow-up period. So basically, you know, if you just observed a cohort for 3 months, it wouldn't meet these inclusion criteria. It needed to be a long enough period of time for health-related events to actually happen. And the study needed to be included in the meta, studies needed to examine the relationship between resistance training and the outcomes of interest, which were mortality and non-communicable disease incidence rates and mortality rates. And the studies either just needed to look at resistance training or a combination of both resistance and aerobic training. And the fourth criteria was just that the study needed to be published in English, which is pretty standard. So they found all of the studies that met those inclusion criteria. There were 7 of them, I believe. And they analyzed the data 3 different ways. First, they just started with kind of binary meta-analyses. So, you know, do people who engage in resistance training have lower rates of all-cause mortality than people who don't? So just, do you resistance train? Yes, no, binary variable, boom, that's it. Then the second set of analyses they did were dose response analyses. So in studies that reported not just did people do resistance training, but also how much resistance training did they do, they looked to see the relationship between how much resistance training someone did and the outcome variables of interest. And then the third set of meta-analyses they did were basically looking at the outcomes of interest, so all-cause mortality and non-communicable disease risk, and their relationship with resistance training in isolation, aerobic training in isolation, and a combination of both resistance and aerobic training to see if one versus the other form of exercise was driving the associations observed, or if the combination of both might be more beneficial than either in isolation. So that is how they analyzed the data. So just starting with the simplest meta-analyses they did, just the binary analyses, they found that people who engaged in resistance training had lower, statistically significantly lower rates of all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease incidence, total cancer incidence, and diabetes incidence than people who did not engage in resistance training. And for all of those outcomes, the relative risk was like 12 to 17% lower. So like a 15% reduction for all-cause mortality, 17% for cardiovascular disease, 12% for total cancer, and 17% for diabetes. So, you know, depending how you look at it, the way I interpret that is relatively small reductions in risk. So we're not talking about 90% reductions in risk or anything like that, but relatively small but notable and consistent reductions in risk. So not only do the pooled effect estimates suggest a reduction in risk of all of these things, but the figure in the paper indicates that for all of the individual studies that were included in this meta-analysis, the point estimate for all of them suggested a reduction in risk. So this was a pretty reliable observed effect in all of the studies that met these inclusion criteria, which is good to see. Then I'm going to skip the dose response meta, because that is where we're going to spend most of our time, and skip on over to the analyses looking at resistance training alone, aerobic training alone, and a combination. So there were enough studies looking at all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease mortality, total cancer mortality, and colon cancer incidence to be worth analyzing. And I'll note, I wouldn't put all of my eggs in the basket of just taking these results at face value, because a lot of the studies that were included in this meta were not looking at these specific outcomes, separating out both resistance and aerobic training. So the previous analyses I mentioned had like 7 studies going into them. All of these just had 3 or 4 studies in each, or 2 or 3 studies in each analysis. So quite a bit lower power, much wider confidence intervals. So, you know, these are kind of more up in the air, but the overall trend is that the reduction in all of those outcomes I mentioned, all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease mortality, cancer mortality, and colon cancer incidence, the point estimate for the relative risk reduction with both aerobic and strength training combined was larger than the relative risk reduction with either aerobic training alone or resistance training alone. So for a lot of those outcomes, the difference between those 3 categories wasn't statistically significant because, like I mentioned, not as many studies separated out aerobic and resistance training to be able to analyze things on this granular of a level. But at least the point estimates suggest that maybe a combination of aerobic and resistance training, a little bit better than either form in isolation, which is good to see. And then finally, the dose response stuff, which I think is the most relevant to the people who ask this question and are interested in this. Like, you know, hey, if I just want to be healthy, how much resistance training should I be doing? And I also think that this is maybe the most potentially controversial set of analyses. So I'm going to tell you what they found, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit more. So there were enough studies to get rough dose response relationships between training duration and all-cause mortality rates, incidence of cardiovascular disease, incidence of total cancer, and incidence of developing type 2 diabetes. And what they found is that for all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease, and total cancer, there was a roughly J-shaped association such that doing some amount of resistance training was associated with lower risk for those outcomes, but past a certain point, continuing to do more resistance training was associated with elevated risk in those outcomes. And for all of them, the dose response relationship is roughly similar. So it seems like doing roughly 30 to 60 minutes of resistance training per week, which I'll note, not all that much resistance training. That is roughly the amount of resistance training that was associated with the largest reductions in risk in all of those outcomes. And past about 130, 140 minutes per week, so like 2.5 hours, past that point, further increases further amounts of resistance training per week was actually associated with elevated all-cause mortality rates, cardiovascular disease risk, total cancer risk. And then, like I mentioned, the last outcome they looked at was diabetes. And they found for that, basically, that you kind of reach a point of diminishing returns after about 60 minutes of resistance training per week. So relatively large reductions in diabetes risk up to about 60 minutes per week, and then further reductions past that point. But the rate at which risk was reduced decreased as the amount of training time increased. So basically, you know, if you do an hour of resistance training per week versus none, that's associated with a relatively large reduction in risk. If you do 4 hours instead of 1 hour, that is associated with an even greater reduction in risk, but not as large as the slope was from 0 minutes to an hour, if that makes sense. So that's basically what they found. And so the obviously the most glass half full interpretation of this is like, you know what, for higher resistance training doses, we're just going to assume on faith that those are spurious correlations and that everything's good, but we're going to take the good part of these findings and say 30 to 60 minutes of resistance training per week, that is the largest, or like that is clear, that clearly seems to be associated with reductions in all-cause mortality rates, cardiovascular disease, cancer. So we're going to take that and say, 30 to 60 minutes, that's all you really need. But also say, and you know what, you can actually do as much as you want, and that's totally fine. Those potential elevations with that J-shaped curve, that's totally spurious, don't even worry about it. That would be, that's what I want to believe. That's kind of like the motivated reasoning interpretation.
And that would be great news, because like back in the day, I did an internship I did some hours at an assisted living facility. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time, the individuals who lived in the facility, I was at the gym, you know, it was an exercise science degree. So I'd be in there and, you know, they'd come in and, you know, maybe one or two times a week when they were watching the news, they'd come do some resistance training. And at the time, I remember thinking like that's such a minimal amount of resistance training. Like mm-hmm. it was almost like my intuition led me to wonder like, what's really the point of getting in there and doing, you know, 30, 60 minutes a week.
Yeah.
So for people like that, you know, that particular finding is really positive, really, mm-hmm. really encouraging.
Yeah. So I actually think I am willing to accept that part of the glass half full interpretation. For a couple reasons. One is just that, like, I looked into several of the individual studies that went into this meta-analysis, and they all observed basically the same thing, that, you know, people who did, you know, get to the gym, do some resistance training just once or twice per week, less than an hour of resistance training, in the studies that fed into this meta-analysis, that was consistently associated with reductions in risk. Like, it wasn't just like a J-shaped curve that's just kind of a statistical artifact that came about when you feed all of these studies into a meta-regression model. So that was a very consistent observation. And, you know, doing a little bit of resistance training over a longer period of time, that is something where there have been like longitudinal intervention studies on, so not just observational studies in community-dwelling older adults. And those studies don't tend to involve a super intensive resistance training intervention. But you know, they're looking at mortality rates, but then also just like maintenance of activities of daily living. And there's a ton of studies on that. And most of them find like, yeah, you take community dwelling older adults, you have them lift a couple days a week. Nah, that tends to improve health outcomes pretty much across the board. On pretty much everything you look at, it seems to have neutral to positive effects. So I do think that there's a causal relationship there. Like older adults do a little resistance training, outcomes across the board for pretty much everything will probably be better than had you not been doing any. And it doesn't seem to take all that much. But then, you know, kind of the more controversial part is the right side of that curve. So are there increased risks of all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease, and cancer if you're doing more than 2.5 hours of resistance training per week? And like I said, it would be nice to just be able to dismiss that out of hand and say, yeah, this must be a spurious correlation. We know resistance training is good for you. There's no way that this association could possibly be indicative of possibly like an underlying causal relationship. But I do think it's worth taking seriously, but I think it's also worth contextualizing. So in cohort studies that are looking at all-cause mortality, they're primarily using cohorts of older adults, which makes sense. You know, if you're interested in the association between some behavior or lifestyle factor and dying, and you want to be able to reliably detect that effect or association, you need a fair number of people to die in your study between enrollment and follow-up. And you don't get that if you're studying 20, 30-year-olds. So most of these studies use older adults. And so, you know, here is a potential explanatory chain. I'm not saying this is for sure what's happening, but I do think it's at least plausible. So, you know, it could be that for older adults, people in their 60s and 70s, you know, with everyone doing resistance training, there is some level of training stress that you can adapt to productively. You put stress on your body adapts to it, you come back bigger, stronger than ever, things are good. And then there's a level of stress past which you can't productively adapt to anymore. And, you know, the nomenclature typically given to that is overtraining, but basically you're just putting more stress on your body than it can cope with. And instead of getting stronger and more robust, it starts breaking down, bad stuff happens. And so it's entirely possible that with older adults, the point past which training tips over from being productive to unproductive and potentially deleterious, it could be like a pretty reasonable amount of training. So not 5-6 hours a week, but maybe 2-2.5 hours per week. So, you know, older adults already have higher baseline levels of oxidative damage, inflammation. It could be that once they're doing more than 2-2.5 hours of resistance training per week, again, on average, like I'm sure it varies person to person, but on average, 2-2.5 hours of resistance training per week, that may be more than their body can cope with and adapt to. And instead of having a overtime net reduction in inflammation and oxidative stress, maybe it's causing net increases, which might accelerate the overall aging process, leading to increases in all-cause mortality and non-communicable chronic disease risk. That, I'm not saying that is for sure what's happening, but that is at least one plausible explanation for these findings that I think is worth considering and taking seriously. However, there are alternate explanations. So one is just that resistance training causally, like with pretty much any dose up to some high threshold, resistance training does causally reduce your risk of all of those things, but it could be that the individuals included in these cohort studies who were doing a lot of resistance training differed from the rest of the cohort in systematic ways. So for example, maybe you get some sort of serious diagnosis or just some blood work comes back that looks really, really bad. And the doctor says like, hey man, like you need to get in shape or bad stuff's going to happen. And so, you know, you say, hey, my time is running out. I need to do what I can to prolong it. I'm just going to start working out like a madman to try to prolong my time on this earth. And so you have maybe a group of people who were already in generally poor health doing a lot more resistance training on average than maybe people who were doing less resistance training but were overall in generally better health. And maybe the resistance training is reducing the risk in the people who were already at high risk, but they still die at higher rates just because they were previously in poor health. Like, again, I'm not saying that is for sure what's happening, but that is another potential explanation.
And there are quite a few plausible medical conditions where you could say, okay, that would really make sense. You know? So it's like, hey, we identified that your bone density is super low. Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of young people fail to appreciate the severity of a major fracture when you start getting into your 70s and 80s. I mean, like the...
Oh, yeah. Like if someone just starts doing 3 hours of resistance training per week because they're doing rehab after a hip fracture, like,
yeah,
dude, they're... I don't want to catastrophize it, but like that person's in bad shape to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the percentage of older individuals who die within 1 year of a serious hip fracture is so much higher than you would anticipate, you know, or, you know, any number of conditions that lead to frailty, muscle wasting, et cetera. Mm-hmm. For all of those, you would tell someone, hey, you need to get into the gym extra.
Yeah.
Just to back up your point, there are many, many scenarios where you could say, okay, yeah, that does seem like a plausible explanation.
Yeah. So I think the way I interpret this personally is that if someone asks, hey, you know, I want to do some resistance training for the primary goal of being healthy, I feel very comfortable telling them that 30 to 60 minutes per week, not all that much resistance training, is probably going to do almost exclusively good things for you. Seems to be safe and well-tolerated in the vast majority of populations, reliably associated with reduced risk of premature death and a bunch of non-communicable diseases. So yeah, if you want the better safe than sorry recommendation for like, hey, I want to do some resistance training for the purpose of health, do about an hour a week. That'll probably get the job done. Doesn't have to be anything crazy. As far as the right side of that curve goes, I personally am in wait and see mode. I really want to be able to reject it out of hand and say, ah, this is definitely a spurious association. But I also, it would be intellectually dishonest for me to do that, because I don't think the evidence exists for me to say that is a for sure type thing. Like, it's an association that exists, and we simply don't know. I think people dismiss associations out of hand too much. Like, the saying correlation is not causation, I think, has poisoned the mind of so many people, where it's almost interpreted to mean correlation is never causation. And it's more just like, hey, correlation may or may not be indicative of an underlying causal relationship. And at this point, we see the association. We don't know if it is causal or not, or if it is a mere association, maybe a spurious association, who's to say? So I'm kind of in wait and see mode there. Like I said, I do think that, especially for younger listeners, like people below 60, you probably don't need to worry about it, because again, the cohorts in this meta-analysis, mostly older adults. And so I strongly don't suspect that doing 3-4 hours of lifting per week is dangerous for younger adults. For older adults, I would also like to say that it's totally fine, but I legitimately don't know. So I do think that, like, I think the way that I would thread this is to say, if you're asking me, hey, how much lifting should I do if my primary goal is health? I'd say, probably about an hour a week. If you,
for an older adult or for anybody?
For anyone. Okay. Like, I think that's probably fine.
Yeah.
If someone came to me and said, like, you know, hey, I've been doing 3-4 hours of lifting per week for the last 50 years, you know, is that dangerous, or can I stick with it? I think at that point, I think that's a conversation to have with your doctor. Like, I don't feel comfortable enough definitely saying that the increased association with risk from this meta-analysis is definitely something you need to be concerned about. And I'm also not comfortable saying it's definitely something to not be concerned about. So at higher amounts of resistance training, that's a conversation for you and your doctor. But relatively low amounts, 30 to 60 minutes per week, seems to be associated with a bunch of good stuff. So if you're primarily lifting for health, that is probably what I would recommend.
Unfortunately, I'm going to blow a hole in that hypothetical scenario that you just laid out, because I do happen to have a friend who mm-hmm. is in their 70s, who has been lifting regularly for like 50 years. And good luck telling him to scale it down, because that ain't going
to
happen.
I'm not telling him to scale it down. I'm telling him to ask his doctor if his doctor thinks he should scale it down.
Good luck to his... Yeah, actually, I've talked to him, and his doctor was unsuccessful in those types of conversations. But no, I think what's really challenging with this particular conversation is, you know, you want to draw some form of conclusion that yeah. is, actionable, and actually chooses some, you know, number that people can use. But there are potential issues on both sides of where you draw that line, right? So if you take the ultra conservative approach that almost seems like discouraging older adults from lifting the way they enjoy, you know, you might be putting people to some extent in harm's way, because they're not accessing some of the various benefits of resistance training, theoretically. But then if you say, oh no, go for it, there's clearly nothing here to worry about, then again, you know, there is potential for harm on both sides, whether you err on the excessively conservative side or the excessively less conservative side. You know, whichever way you go with that, there is some theoretical potential for harm, mm-hmm. or at least theoretical potential for limiting benefit, you know? Yeah. So that was, it was really challenging, like, to be candid, when we were doing the review process internally for your mass article, that internal peer review that we do with all the authors, that was the thing that kept going through my head, was like, how do you try to arrive at a conclusion here that's consistent with the evidence, but also very cautious about catastrophizing the idea of resistance training for older individuals? So I think you did a great job with it, though. It's really tough to try to thread that needle. And I agree, like it would not be, I think the way you put it was intellectually dishonest to just discard it because it is inconvenient.
It definitely doesn't fit my priors. It doesn't fit my biases. I don't want that association to exist, but it does. And so it's just a question of like, how do we handle it?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, it would be, intellectually dishonest and incompatible with the evidence.
Or at least intellectually lazy.
Yeah. But it is there, and it's something that ought to be dealt with when you're discussing this topic. I'm also, when you look at the huge array of health benefits that are observed in a more causative manner in the longitudinal interventions in older adults, it just highlights that challenge of like, well, how do we make sure we're maximizing the benefits we see in those longitudinal trials while also being mindful of this, this correlation that seems to be apparent? It's challenging stuff.
Yeah. And I will say, one of the things that, bums me out a little bit. So I'm like congenitally anti-authority, and I want to believe that, expert organizations are all just like dumb and full of shit. And I used to think that about like the ACSM's guidelines for this stuff. But like the more I look into it, the more I think like, they were probably right. Couple resistance training sessions per week, hitting all major muscle groups, 3 to 5 days of some amount of moderate to vigorous aerobic activity. Like as more and more research comes out, like all of that stuff does seem to be associated with pretty good outcomes. So unfortunately, I got to give it to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, we've got plenty of listener questions that we want to answer here. So I'm going to start and just kind of go rapid fire through a few of them, and then I'll kick it over to you.
Yeah, go for it.
How many were you planning to answer?
I don't know. I think it depends on the time. Maybe you do two, I do two, and then we can do some of the ones that we're both going to address.
Cool. Yeah, and I might do more than two, but just because I'm going like really, really quick through them here, which I say every episode and never do, but this is the one time.
And then
time
I call you
different.
Out for it, and then when it's my swing, I take twice as long as you do.
Exactly. At least we have a system.
We do, yeah. It's consistent.
So I've got a question from Caspars, and the question is, when talking about pre-sleep protein, which we've mentioned on the show several times before, the question is, are we talking about 20 or 30 minutes before bed with the protein ingestion, or are we talking about 2 or 3 hours before bed? And what they're getting at is, they're based on the question, they're a little concerned about this idea of pre-bed food intake interfering with sleep quality, because our stomach can get upset, body temperature can be elevated due to digestion, which can be unfavorable for sleep. You want to kind of get your core temperature down a little bit for sleep. So is it really worth sacrificing sleep quality in order to promote muscle protein synthesis? So as I've mentioned on previous episodes, I think we've talked about it on the show, I'm not convinced that the pre-bed feeding opportunity is a unique opportunity. I think as long as you're getting ideally somewhere between 3 to 6 servings of protein throughout the day, I don't think it's critical to have one of those be 20 minutes before bed or 2 hours before bed. I just simply don't think it matters based on the evidence available. Now, the question about that trade-off of, let's say it's late at night and you're like, I've only gotten a couple protein feedings in, should I go for it or should I be worried about interfering with sleep? The question was, what do the studies actually do? If you're looking at the studies that look at nighttime protein specifically impacting body composition, those do provide protein relatively close to bedtime. So the most common approach that you'll see in that small collection of studies is going to be a protein shake. So it'll be a liquid form of protein given somewhere between 30 to 90 minutes before bed, somewhere in that time frame. The problem is with those studies, because they're so focused on body composition, they really don't say much about how it impacted sleep quality. It's kind of up in the air. There are a couple studies I've reviewed over the past couple years in Mass that have looked at pre-bed protein, different types of protein with different amounts of tryptophan and how those might influence sleep. Because tryptophan is a precursor to serotonin and melatonin. And so having elevated tryptophan in the brain at night could theoretically promote, quicker onset of sleep in addition to better sleep quality. So for those studies where they actually looked at sleep quality, they did have it kind of further away from bedtime. We're talking about like 2 or 3 hours before bed. So while those studies give us an opportunity to look at how this protein is impacting sleep quality, unfortunately, it's pretty far removed from sleep time, like I said, a couple hours at minimum. And so it doesn't really get to the root of this question, which is like, should I chug a protein shake right before bed, or is that going to mess up my sleep? So the research available, unfortunately, it kind of takes one of two approaches so far, which is either put it close to bed and don't measure sleep quality, or put it further from bed and do measure sleep quality. And I don't think that's intentional. I think that's just the way it goes when you're looking at a body of literature that is very small, and they haven't really had an opportunity to test through all different permutations of timing and outcome measurements. So I, for now, would recommend just using a little bit of trial and error. I think a lot of times sleep disruption related to pre-bed meal intake can be really complicated. So you want to go to bed. You certainly don't want to be too hungry, because that can interfere with sleep for sure. Just ask any bodybuilder. That becomes one of the hardest things in prep, in my opinion, is trying to sleep when hungry. But you also don't want to be too full. That can be uncomfortable. And like the question suggests, you can have that discomfort of digestion, elevated body temperature, things like that. So you want to be not too hungry, not too full. But you also have to consider, what does this meal look like? So some of these studies, they'll just give a liquid protein shake, very, very easy to digest. And that's quite different from a very unprocessed meal with a bunch of fat in it, a bunch of fiber intake. So the things that often disrupt sleep when consumed before bed, usually a fatty meal, especially if it tends to be pretty spicy, that is not a good combination for a pre-bed meal that would support really good sleep. But I think a lot of this is very susceptible to variation between individuals. I think you probably want to do some trial and error, see if a particular pre-bed meal disrupts your sleep. If it does, you might go for something that's more digestible. You might change up your food sources, or you might change the timing. And like I've said previously, if you decide to just move that pre-bed meal to way earlier and kind of miss out on that feeding opportunity immediately before sleep, I really don't think you're sacrificing much in the process. Another question that I'm just going to very briefly mention here is from Dan Feldman. You should check him out on Instagram, by the way. I forget his handle. It has powerlifter. Is it powerlifter dietitian, maybe?
I think it's powerlifting dietitian. I will verify that as you're talking.
So Dan Feldman, great guy. Check him out on Instagram. He asked if I've come across any research on cannabis, and specifically THC rather than CBD, and how they impact strength or hypertrophy. And first of all, Dan, shame on you. You shouldn't be asking about this stuff on the show. But I would encourage listeners to check out episode 13 of the podcast, where I did a kind of a detailed answer to a similar question. And I talked about THC and CBD. And unfortunately, I haven't really seen a lot of new stuff since then in terms of peer-reviewed literature looking at the effects of THC. There was one newer study since then on CBD, I'm still a little bit unconvinced about CBD and how it might relate to recovery specifically. That's where a lot of the research is focused right now. There's some mixed evidence, but just a general lack of evidence overall. When it comes to THC, like I said, I mentioned some of the original research in episode 13, but just to recap, it seems to be fairly benign in terms of performance outcomes, recovery. There are a lot of anecdotes suggesting that athletes do use cannabis in a percentage of frequency of use that I found a little bit surprising, or the prevalence, I should say. One of the studies, I'm going to link a couple reviews in the show notes for people who are interested in this topic. But one study reported that about 23% of athletes that were surveyed reported using cannabis within the past year, which I thought was pretty high. But they mentioned that it was actually lower than the general population among people of similar age, which apparently is about 32% for people between 18 and 25 years old. So just really shocking, horrifying numbers to see the prevalence that high. But you know, when we look at the anecdotes, you know, a lot of athletes do use it. Usually they'll say that they use it for reasons just totally unrelated to sport. Or they might say, yeah, it seems to help with just like resting, which kind of indirectly helps with recovery. You see some people mention that it helps them sleep better. I've heard people arguing on behalf of there was a conversation about removing it from the National Football League drug testing list, and the argument that I saw that was anecdotal was like, hey, you've got a lot of NFL players who are using some pretty harsh drugs to deal with pain related to the sport, and their argument was like, you should let them use cannabis and then they can use that to manage pain instead of some of these much harsher drugs. Again, completely anecdotal.
I mean, football is already such a violent sport, and based on the documentary Reefer Madness, I don't think that putting more cannabis into the mix would improve that.
It's an interesting perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so anecdotally, like, athletes certainly do seem to use it. I doubt that it would be particularly ergolytic in terms of strength, hypertrophy, recovery. You know, the one obvious thing is like inhaling combustion products generally isn't good for your lungs, especially if you rely on those lungs for the sport that you do. So that's something to keep in mind. But, you know, unfortunately, there's just not a lot of research here. I'll link a couple reviews in the show notes where people can dig in and see exactly what's been done in the research. But the short answer is, frankly, not that much.
Also, just verifying, Dan's Instagram handle is powerlifter dietitian.
Awesome. Check Dan out. But once again, shame on you, Dan. Quick question here from Maslin. Maslin recently heard that creatine should be taken immediately post-workout for it to be effective. They were wondering what my perspective is on that. There's one or two small studies suggesting that it might be slightly more advantageous to consume creatine post-workout rather than consuming it pre-workout. The difference observed in those two studies was quite small. Nothing that would warrant too much focus or effort or attention. When it comes to creatine, I usually tell people, just if you plan on taking it, just work it into your day in a way that is most convenient for you, so that it will be, you know, the biggest issue with creatine is just forgetting to take it. A lot of people mention that, oh yeah, I'm technically on creatine, but I only remember like 2 or 3 days a week, which isn't necessarily a problem, but I think consistency is the biggest thing with creatine rather than timing. So whatever's most convenient for you, the only thing that I would add to that in terms of assessing the best time for you is keep an eye out about how your stomach is reacting to creatine. So some people do mention that they have some GI distress with creatine supplementation, especially at higher doses. If you go to strongerbyscience.com/creatine, I think that's the URL. We have a whole section on navigating what to do if creatine is causing some GI discomfort, but you would like to continue using it. There are some different strategies about You know, when you take it, how many doses you spread it across, whether you consume it with a meal, whether you're consuming it with something that's caffeinated. There are a number of different things you can explore to try to navigate that issue and to try to attenuate some of that GI discomfort associated with creatine consumption. And then I'll do one more here. I've got a question from George's. How do you say George with an S on the end?
I don't know.
George's? I don't know. But anyway, the question is, you're planning on 3 meals a day in this hypothetical scenario, but you're getting toward the end of the day and you realize you already hit your protein target in your first 2 meals. So it's the end of the day. You've got extra calories left. You got another meal to eat, but you've already hit your protein target. What should you do? And from my perspective, there's really 3 options here. So option A is stick to your calorie target, have a low protein meal, and, you know, just say, whatever, I already got my protein in, not worry about it. I'll just, you know, have a carb and fat heavy meal, and that's that. Another option would be, I'm going to, you know, force more protein into meal 3 at the expense of hitting my carb and fat targets. Because that's what we're really trying to do here, is kind of juggle around protein, carbs, and fats. So option A, like I said, is just hit your carb and fat target and let your protein be low in order to facilitate that. Option B would be force more protein into meal number 3 so that it's providing a pretty substantial third protein dose for the day. And you'd be doing that at the expense of carb or fat intake. So you'd be going higher on your protein for the day, but lower on your carbs and fats. And then the final option, and you could add more if you wanted, but I'm just kind of simplifying here. Another option is to force some more protein into that third meal and to just go over your calorie target. So still aim for your fat and carbohydrate target as they were at the beginning of the day, but you would just go over your protein target and therefore go over your calorie target. And so which of those 3 is ideal for you really just depends on your current priority and the current goal that you're pursuing. So if you're cutting, I would recommend option A or B. When you're cutting, the most important thing there is going to be making sure that you're being pretty consistent with your overall calorie target. And so I would not want to force more protein in there if it was going to push me above my calorie target. So that could involve just having a low protein third meal, or it could involve bumping more protein into meal 3 at the expense of carbs and fats. But ultimately, you don't want to be pushing over that calorie target. If you are maintaining, or you are recomping, or you are bulking, but you're really adamant about staying as lean as possible during your bulk, again, I would say that A or B would be the preferred approaches, because they're going to keep you on line with your calorie target, or keep you in line with your calorie target. If you're bulking, but you know it's something that, you know, you really have to mind the details in order to continuously make progress. So like, you're not enjoying some of those beginner gains when you first get into lifting, but you're historically a hard gainer, or you're just like really near your genetic potential, or you're just not a very high responder to resistance training. So for you to gain muscle, optimizing those variables is critical. If you're in that situation, I'd say B or C would be preferable, making sure that you're getting a third dose of protein, because like I said, in this scenario, you're a person who has identified that, you know, gains are really hard to come by. And so you really need to make sure you're getting at least that third protein serving to make sure that you're supporting muscle gaining and just optimizing that process as much as you possibly can. And then, of course, if you're bulking and you're just simply not that worried about a little bit of fat gain, then C would I think, be the way to go. You know, go ahead and put a little extra protein into meal 3. It'll push you over your calorie target for the day, but really not a big deal. And that, you know, whichever situation you're in, this is not something, this, you know, theoretical scenario shouldn't be causing a lot of stress. You know, if it happens rarely, then by definition, it's not a major problem. It's not going to put your weekly or monthly intakes way off course. So if it's happening rarely, then by definition, it's not something that's really worth worrying about too much. If it's happening frequently, then that probably is a sign that you want to go back to the drawing board a little bit. So you want to figure out, you know, why am I consistently running into this situation, and what can I do to reinforce some better alignment between my dietary goals, my dietary targets, and my actual dietary habits. And so that a lot of times that's when you're finding that you're constantly running into these scenarios where you need a quick kind of like strategy or workaround, or I'm in a dilemma here, what do I do? When you find yourself in those situations consistently, that's usually an indicator that there's some degree of misalignment between your dietary targets and your dietary habits. And so if you continuously find yourself in these jams where it takes a lot of effort to try to find a way out of a problem that comes up, that's usually an indication that, you know, whatever the short-term solution is kind of beside the point. We need to look at the bigger picture, go back to the drawing board, and figure out how are we going to restructure some dietary habits so that they're more suitable for the dietary targets that are in place, or how are we going to adjust those dietary targets so that they're more compatible with the dietary habits that you currently use. All right, so I think that does it for the questions I wanted to answer. I did a pretty good job staying short with that.
Yeah, that was solid.
All right, you want to do one or two?
Yeah, sure. Where are we at time-wise?
We are at just over an hour.
Okay, yeah, all right. So let's see, I solicited some more questions yesterday from the Facebook group and subreddit. There were still some older questions that I hadn't addressed yet, so I'm going to start with those. And people who recently submitted questions, I will probably get to those in like the next episode or two episodes from now. But I think I'm going to stick with older questions for this one. Theta Cheesed from Reddit asks, why does the strict overhead press scale so hard with body weight compared to other lifts, particularly the jerk? In Open Strongman, there have been competitors at the top level that are competitive using a strict press against others push presses, but this isn't really a thing in lower weight classes. So why is that? So that's a good question. I had never really considered it before. And so my first thought is, hey, you know, there could just be some selection bias there. For all competitive strongmen, we don't know what their PR press is versus their PR jerk. So let's try to find a population where they were training both of those lifts very hard, and we roughly know what their best numbers were. And so there is an ideal place that you can look for data there, and that is the old school weightlifting records. So these days, weightlifting is just snatch and clean and jerk, but until 1973, it also included the clean and press. And so to be a really good weightlifter, you needed to be able to be good at jerking the bar and pressing the bar. So we have old data roughly indicating the relationship between maximum jerk strength and maximum press strength in elite level athletes who were training both of those lifts really hard for the purpose of competition. And when we look at that, there's some degree of interpretation that goes on. So you could look at this data and say, you know what? There actually doesn't seem to be that much of a relationship between body weight and the gap between maximum jerk and maximum press. So for example, in the 52 kilo weight class, there was like a 12 kilo difference between the world record clean and jerk and the world record clean and press. And in the 110 kilo weight class, it was like a 9 kilo difference. And pretty much every weight class is somewhere between like a 10 kilo difference and a 20 kilo difference. And it doesn't really seem to vary that much. But on the flip side, you could look at it and make the case that maybe the gap is shrinking over the body weight range that is relevant to strongman. So for example, like the lightest, like really competitive strongman class is 90 kilos or like right around 200 pounds. There is an even lighter weight class. I think it's like 175, but it tends to not have that many entrants. So you have a weight class around 200 pounds. You have a 105 class or 231 pounds. And then you have a super heavy class. Like those are, I think, the three most competitive strongman classes. And over that weight range, just looking at the records that were set, there was like a 12 and a half kilo difference between clean and jerk and clean and press at 90 kilos. In weightlifting, 110 kilo class 242, there was a 9 kilo difference. So a little bit smaller. Don't know if we want to make all that big of a deal about that slight difference, but you know, maybe it's indicative of something. And then in the super heavyweight class, there was but a 1 kilo difference between the best clean and jerk and the best clean and press of that era. Vasily Alexeyev clean and jerked 237.5, and he clean and pressed 236.5. So, you know, you could look at that and be like, you know, maybe the gap is shrinking for the super heavies. Alternately, you could just say, hey, Alexeyev was a freak level presser, and, you know, maybe that's not indicative of all that much. And I don't know. For me personally, I think that is the case. I could be totally wrong, but like Lasha has clean and jerked close to 600 pounds. I don't think he can clean and press 600. And I don't think he could press 600 strictly if he trained for it. I could be totally wrong, but I do sort of think that Alexeyev, maybe not that great of a clean and jerker, like relatively to modern athletes, but just a tremendous presser. So, you know, it is a bit of a Rorschach test, but I don't see in weightlifters like super strong evidence that the gap between press strength and jerk strength really varied all that much as weight classes increased. I think there may be a little bit of that going on for reasons that I'm not particularly sure about. But I think the bigger factor in play is just that in the heavyweight class, the weights are so fucking heavy that it selects for athletes who are static strength monsters. Because if they weren't, they would just zero a ton of events. And so I think it's just a sport that selects for people who are just going to be tremendously good pressers because they're tremendously gifted for static strength. And, you know, some of them may also get a little bit extra out of a push press or out of a jerk. But a lot of them just don't need it because they have to be so statically strong to not just zero almost all of the events. And so I think that if I was trying to chalk it up to just one reason, I think that's mostly it, like athlete selection. Whereas some of the lighter classes, you know, athletes with tremendous static strength also do very well, but there are some more lighter events where more explosive or faster or more endurant athletes have more of an advantage. So I think it's mostly just a matter of athlete selection at the top level. But I could be wrong about that. But just taking a stab at answering that question, I think that is the most likely explanation. Lifter in the Rye asks, we've had a lot of discussion around optimal protein intake. What happens if you massively undereat protein? Like, let's say I'm 100 kilograms and massively jacked, and I decide to start eating 10 grams of protein a day. Do I just implode or what? You probably won't implode, but bad things could happen. You will probably start losing muscle relatively quickly, and you might run into some boutique issues related to deficiencies in specific amino acids, but more likely than not, like a very early indicator would just be that you would likely develop anemia. And so you'd be super fatigued all the time. And then you're really fatigued all the time. You go to the doctor and you say like, hey, I feel like shit all the time. What's going on? They say, dude, you're super anemic. What are you eating? Oh, no protein. Okay, cool. Eat some protein. So that's probably what would happen if you just pushed on through. You have essential amino acids. They're called essential for a reason. If you're just eating 10 grams of protein per day, you're probably not eating adequate levels of at least one of those essential amino acids. And so just over time, there would be proteins that would break down, need replacing. You wouldn't be able to replace them. And so, you know, it would vary person to person, like what link in the chain broke first, but eventually you'd die. But you would become anemic before you died and get that indicator that, hey, something is going on that I probably need to do something about. So that is what would happen. Seth Markham from Facebook asks, how much does one's volume for a particular muscle affect, positively or negatively, hypertrophy for other muscles? I know that's a broad question, but I'm curious what the known give and take is as far as recovery and muscle protein synthesis, and how one could potentially elicit more growth in a specific area by adjusting volume for other areas. So I think that's a great question, and it's an area where there's not a ton of research, but I think we can piece maybe a tentative answer together. So first off, there is the potential that the answer to this question is different for upper versus lower body. So I can't remember the episode, but it was a long time ago, like at least a year, year and a half ago. I talked about a study that was looking at some, I think that study was just looking at acute hormonal changes with just upper body training versus a combination of upper and lower body training. And some of the results indicated that, like, maybe doing some lower body training puts you in a slightly more anabolic environment overall. And digging into some of the other research that has looked at that question, there is, I would say, definitely not conclusive evidence that doing lower body training can boost upper body hypertrophy, but there's at least some hint that potentially training upper and lower body together might potentially result in a little bit more upper body hypertrophy than only doing upper body training. Again, I am not, we're far from me feeling very confident saying that that is for sure the case, but based on the research that exists, like there is a slight hint that that might be the case. And it's hard to say what exactly the mechanism for that could be. Could just be a handful of small studies that had some spurious results, but you know, there is that hint. And then on the opposite side of things, there is a hint that maybe doing upper body training with lower body training could potentially maybe hinder lower body hypertrophy a little bit. And so this is even more tentative. So either last episode or two episodes ago, Eric talked about the McNaughton study that looked at the muscle protein synthesis response to 20 versus 40 grams of protein in people with low lean body mass versus high lean body mass, finding that it didn't seem in that study like the people with high lean body mass maybe needed more protein to maximize acute muscle protein synthesis response than the people with low lean body mass. But Eric cautioned against taking that like super at face value, like, yeah, you know, there's other lines of research. This is just one acute muscle protein synthesis study. Not going to rehash all of that, but in that same study, so that was kind of the third study in a string of three studies that all used similar designs. So you give, you put lifters through a workout and you give them either 20 or 40 grams of protein and you see whether there are differences in protein synthesis between 20 and 40 grams of protein. And the first two studies only used a lower body training stimulus, and the McNaughton study used a full body training stimulus, but measured muscle protein synthesis of the quads. And when you look at those three studies together, the overall training stimulus for the lower body seemed to be roughly comparable, the difference being in the McNaughton study, people were also doing some upper body training. And if you just compare those three studies, the elevation in muscle protein synthesis in the quads in the McNaughton study was like 20-30% lower than the elevations in muscle protein synthesis in the other two prior studies that had used a similar design. And so I don't necessarily think it's advisable to compare different studies with different cohorts completely apples to apples. But if one were to do that, you could make a very weak case that maybe doing some upper body training along with lower body training might reduce muscle protein synthesis of the lower body muscles a little bit. So if you wanted to take the maximally liberal kind of like biohackery, like a suggestion is fine, we don't need proof approach to this, you can maybe make the case that if you want to maximize upper body hypertrophy, you should be doing some lower body training And if you want to optimize lower body hypertrophy, maybe you should avoid doing too much upper body training. That again is the maximally liberal interpretation. My personal take is that it probably doesn't matter all that much. That's not necessarily something that I've seen play out in practice. And again, the research supporting that interpretation is very weak and very tenuous. But I do think that I think that it's mostly just a matter of like overall dose and a question of whether the training you're doing for one muscle group detracts from your ability to train another muscle group really hard. So talking to some bench specialists back in the day, one of the things that they consistently told me is like, you got to do lower body training. You don't want to look like a popsicle, like huge upper body walking around on chicken legs. But like, you know, we mostly just do some machine training for lower body, maybe some squats, mostly avoid deadlifts. I was like, oh, why do you avoid deadlifts? And they're like, dude, like if it fries your upper back, you just don't have as stable of a base to bench on. If your erectors get fatigued and sore, you can't arch as well. Like if I train the deadlift too hard, I just can't put as much effort into my bench training as I want. And so like by cutting back on deadlift training, that improves my bench results. Like that's something I've heard from probably a dozen bench specialists. Like a lot of bench specialists don't like deadlifts. And, you know, that could also just be motivated reasoning. It's like, hey, I'm a bench specialist because I have really short arms. And as a result, I also suck at deadlifting. So I'm going to invent a reason why I shouldn't deadlift. But that is something that a lot of bench specialists say. And I think there is probably something to that, you know, if you want to maximize how hard you can train a particular muscle, if there's some other exercise that detracts from your ability to put a full level of effort into exercises that train that particular muscle, it might detract from your results a little bit. But ultimately I think most of that is stuff that you can probably train around. And I personally, after laying out the maximally liberal case for why it may matter, I personally think that it likely doesn't matter. Like when you look at the most jacked people in the world, most of them don't have like just glaring holes in muscular development. And you know, even if they have a particular muscle that may jump out to you as like, ooh, that's underdeveloped, like it's probably still like way bigger than the average person's. Like if you see a huge jacked bodybuilder with tiny calves, their tiny calves are probably still enormous. It's just the rest of them is so much bigger. It doesn't seem like hugely jacked people are really missing out on much by not neglecting certain muscles. I personally don't think it makes all that much of a difference. Let's see. Those were all of the old ones. Let me see if I have time for one other newer one.
We're at 118.
Yeah, so. Okay. I'll leave all of the newer ones. Let's do some collaborative questions.
Well, we have time for one. Which one would you like to do?
Let's do debating people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, this is a question that comes up from time to time. And the question is always just, why don't you debate blank, right? And sometimes I'll get like tagged in something. And, hey, you two should go at it in a battle of wits and see who comes out victorious and wins over the perspectives of the listening audience. And so this whole approach of debating people, you know, hey, let's get on a YouTube channel, let's get on a podcast, and we'll hash it out. It's become really popular, like really common in fitness and in nutrition. But in my opinion, it's a somewhat lousy way to handle a lot of the topics that are being debated. From my perspective, a debate is really useful for discussions about big picture ideas, big picture concepts, things that are, you know, theoretical, debates related to certain ideologies, things like that. most of the, you know, when it's really logic driven or really theory driven, and it's more about kind of a rationalist perspective of like, well, let's put together the logic here and walk through it. I think that lends itself more to the debate format, but a lot of times in nutrition and exercise, it's like, let's quibble over the details about what this specific study actually found and what that means for, you know, the question or the topic at hand. And I think a great example of how to do debate in fitness and nutrition, in my opinion, or one that I at least felt good about, was when we went back and forth with Menno Henselmans about the whole P ratio discussion. We've talked about it on the show. We've got the articles on the website. It took the form of, we will present a case and then someone else will kind of, you know, say, well, actually, here's what I believe. And, you know, I think you missed this in that study. And here's a study you didn't consider. It takes the written form and it goes back and forth. And that allows the individuals who are involved in the discussion to sit through it, you know, sit down, think through it, go back to the research and critically read and interpret that research and see if, maybe I did misinterpret something. Maybe I did miss something in the supplementary file that they've brought my attention to. But it's the type of thing where a lot of times when you hear these fitness and nutrition debates on like a YouTube channel or a podcast, it's all on the fly. And someone will say, this study found X. And the other person will say, I disagree. And usually there's not a lot of room there to dig into the details. And let's say, well, let's pause. I'm going to bring that paper up. Give me about 10 minutes to dig into it. And then we'll revisit this. That never happens because that's awful for the listener or the viewer. So in many cases, I think that the debate format, just in terms of a live in-person audio or video debate, I think it's just not very suitable for digging into the actual literature and coming away with the most accurate, most nuanced conclusions from that literature. You really do have to dive back in. And in some cases, another reason I don't like to do these is because a lot of times people go into it with a completely formed conclusion, right? Yeah. So like one of the things that comes up is like, you see these camps in the nutrition world, whether it's like carnivore or vegan or whatever the case may be. And it's like, there's nothing that's going to happen in the next 90 minutes that's going to move me from my position. Both of the speakers in the debate are completely attached to their position. And the audience from each respective speaker is completely entrenched in that position. And there's like this imaginary, maybe real, tiny portion of people in the middle who actually open that up and say, yeah, maybe I am open to being swayed one direction or the other.
Yeah.
And I tend to find, in my opinion, that usually you get swayed by the person who speaks most confidently and not by the person who makes the best actual argument in terms of the accuracy and construction of the argument. So for all those reasons, I don't find it to be a very fruitful endeavor in many cases. But Greg, what do you think?
No, I agree. I think it's I think one of the distinctions you made is very important. So is this a debate about theory where we're using logical reasoning to talk through something, or is it a debate about something scientific where we're relying on sources, we're citing and interpretations of those sources to make a case? I think those are two very different types of debates. And if it's more of just kind of like the logical rationalist debate, you can do that in real time. I think most people, or a lot of people, still do that in bad faith, but that is at least something that could theoretically be productive to do in real time. But I very much agree that if it's a debate about something related to science and evidence, I think it's virtually impossible to do it in real time, in a debate format, in a way that is both in good faith and interesting. So, and the reason I say it's impossible to do in good faith, or very challenging to do in good faith, is if someone else is citing evidence to support their point, you have basically three options you can do. And two of them are quick and one of them are slow. Option one is just to dismiss what they're saying, which isn't debating in good faith, I don't think. Option two is to just accept what they're saying, which may be a, which is a weak debate tactic. Like you're just ceding ground, perhaps unnecessarily, because you might need to look at that source for yourself. So you're probably not going to do that. And then the third option is very slow, which is looking at the source, reading it, carefully considering it, which you just can't do in a live debate format. And the other thing is you can do that if and only if both people engaged in the debate intimately know every source that they are citing and the other person is citing inside and out, to the point that they can quibble about the details in real time, which I have never seen that happen. So so that could occur in theory, and that could lead to a productive debate, and it would also be a hideously boring debate for all of the readers who aren't intimately aware of all of those sources inside and out. So yeah, I don't think it's ever, like, I just don't think it's ever going to be particularly fruitful. And yeah, that's,
yeah, like you were saying, so someone wanted me to debate someone, and I was like, this person was just making the rounds, just debating everybody who would jump on a call. And I went and listened to one of their debates, and they did a kind of exactly what you're referring to, where like someone brought up a point and they were like, nah, that study's clearly fake, because there's, and it, like, you could look into other research mm-hmm. if it was in a written kind of form.
Yeah.
And you could say, well, I question the veracity of that data based on this other evidence, which makes it look very, very questionable. But in real time, like you said, all it was just a gut instinct and a hunch. And it was like, ah, that's fake news. And like, anyway, let's move on. I reject your data. Do you have anything else? And it was completely not useful.
Yeah.
And the other thing that happened was the person asserted a particular point, and the other person was like, yeah, I've never seen that in the research. I don't know which research you're talking about. And they're like, well, it exists. So, I mean, that's on you. And they just misrepresented it to the point that even if you knew the study, you'd have no idea what they were referring to.
Yeah, I mean, that also leads to a difference between written debates and like real-time talking debates, which is that when you're just having a conversation with someone, it's far easier and oftentimes very advantageous to simply lie. Because like, dude, if it's like a written back and forth and there's a point you want to make and you say that there's a study that backs it up, but you don't link it, and you had a week to look for it, and you just say, like, you know what, there was a study that showed X, Y, and Z. Unfortunately, I can't find it. A reader can look at that and know, like, oh, they had a week to formulate this response. They're full of shit. Like, they're clearly lying about this. Whereas, like, that's a very reasonable thing to assert in person. Like, oh, I saw this study. I'm blanking on the title and author. And that could be entirely true and honest. Like, most people don't remember the title and author of every study they've ever read. Or you could simply be lying, and there's no way for the viewer to be able to tell the difference. So yeah, like there's a lot of slimy tactics that work in debates that simply don't work in written back and forths. So yeah. I think that it engenders a level of discourse that's not great. And the other thing I'll say is, as a potential participant, I've never seen an outcome of a debate where someone doesn't wind up getting harassed. Like, as far as I can tell, people who are very into debates, especially like Twitch debates, they just have like Discord servers of lackeys. And like, if someone disagrees with them, it's like, oh yeah, just go harass them on Twitch, go harass them on Twitter. There's like a 75% chance that, like, if you debate someone, especially if you seemingly win the debate and make the other person look bad, there's like a 75% chance you're about to be mobbed by people accusing you of being a pedophile. I don't know how that occurs, but someone always winds up being accused of pedophilia. That's a commonality of virtually all like recent online debates that I've observed. So
it gets really toxic. Like that mob mentality kind of takes over, and then it's these two factions, and someone is getting harassed in the process.
So the
thing, like that debate I mentioned, if you were just kind of observing, you'd say, wow, that person made really confident points that seem to be supported by evidence that they say exists. But you wonder how many listeners took a second to find the vague research that was being alluded to and then say, dude, that's not even close to what you said it was showing, you know, within the debate. Like if you actually dug into the resources, you would find that this debate was built out of like a house of cards and just kind of glued together with like, you know, glue and tape and gum. And like, it was just a terrible argument that was not representative of the underlying evidence. But again, in the debate format, there was no way to actually go through and fact check in a meaningful way.
Well, and I mean, like even if there was a way, like not in real time during the debate, but just viewers after the fact, you know, like the person organizing the debate makes both parties submit all of their sources, link them all in the show notes. Just the way people interact with information, like links in video versus audio content is very different. Like if you're reading an article and they're linking out to something else that they claim supports a point that they're making, you just open another tab. You can skim it. You can go back to what you were reading before. Like that's a very normal thing to do. But you know, if someone in a video cites a source, maybe you're going to pull it up and like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to read that after the video. But like, I don't think virtually anyone pauses the video. They're like, oh, this person cited a source. Let's pause the video, read the source in its entirety, and then come back to the video to see what this person says about it. Theoretically, they could, but like, that's just not how people tend to interact with video content. Whereas I think it's more likely that they'll interact with written content that way.
Yeah, for sure. And then my final point is that due to the road to enlightenment that I traversed in record time, I'm just no longer interested in trying to insist that people agree with me. So like when people say, hey, you should debate this person who disagrees with you, I'm more inclined to say, I'd be happy to defend any of the content I put out on this and to consider rebuttals, but that's kind of where it starts and ends. Like, here's my perspective. Here's why I believe it. I'm of course happy to revise that, but the debate, not really interested. All right, so do you have anything to play us out? I do have something quick, if you don't have anything.
I don't really have anything.
All right, well, I am, unfortunately, I must report. I was hoping to do the second installment of Eric's Seder Stories, which is a fan favorite segment that we've done exactly once on the show. that goes all the way back to season one, I think. My first ever Seder, where
I was the third episode of the podcast.
I think so, yeah. But I was at a Seder, and I mentioned I was a kinesiologist because I never know how to explain what we do for a living. And someone's like, oh, cool. So you work with like crystals and gems and harness their energies and stuff. And it was just a conversation that really went off the rails. I am both relieved and displeased to share that I went to my second Seder this week, and no outrageous conversations like that occurred. So it was a pleasant time, but not great for content. So
that's a shame.
The one thing that I took away from it, though, honestly, was, you know, you hear about people who take the kind of approach to learning a language where they just immerse themselves in it, right? And they're like, yeah, I just like showed up in Spain, lived in a little town, picked it up over time because everybody was speaking Spanish. I think I understand Hebrew less than I did before the Seder. Honestly, I don't know if there's something wrong with my brain where I just, the linguistic part is just totally fused shut. Maybe one of my severe concussions really rattled that part of my brain. But man, immersion is, I don't think that's a viable strategy for me because I genuinely think I lost Hebrew content in my brain because there was all the reading going on and I was completely lost. But I would just kind of sit there, and then when everybody turned their page, I'd be like, all right, turn your page. It'll make it seem like you know what's going on. And I think it worked well. But anyway, last weekend, there were a bunch of holidays. If you happen to celebrate any of them, I hope that you enjoyed them. And I think that does it for this episode of the podcast. So as always, thank you for joining us, and we will be back soon with another episode.
Thank you for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, be sure to sign up for our free newsletter to get concise breakdowns of relevant research, as well as 28 free training programs for all skill levels and all schedules. We hate spam just as much as you do, so we'll only email you when we have something really interesting to share with you. You can sign up for the free newsletter at strongerbyscience.com/newsletter, or just go to the Stronger by Science homepage and click the free programs button at the top. If you want to join in on the Stronger by Science podcast conversation, be sure to check out our Facebook group and our subreddit. The links for both are provided in the description of today's episode. Finally, please remember that we are not medical doctors or registered dietitians. So, before you make any changes to your exercise or nutrition habits, be sure to check with a qualified healthcare professional. Once again, thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of the Stronger by Science podcast.